the market. You walk in. There's one entrance to the market, so when you walk in, you can let your kids run around and not be worried about finding where they ran to, because they're in a confined area. Your kids can go and play in the with the various games we'll have set up, and with a bit of an educational component, but mostly fun. And frankly, some of those games would be good for parents, because some of them are things like identifying vegetables and whatnot. But you can then sit down at the market cafe and have a coffee, and you can sample some of the various goodies that the vendors have for sale. Like you can have a breakfast there or have a piece of pie.
Well, okay, so it sounds very enticing. Okay, well, I guess as a last question, you've got a goal this year of obviously establishing yourself. Let's say this year is really successful. What would your goal be for next year?
For this market? Our goal would be to assess what we did right and what we did wrong. How can we make it a better market for the vendors and the farmers? How can we make it a better experience for customers, but still be true to our initial philosophy, which is to have a market that's focused on local food?
Okay, and could you again give the URL so that people can go online to get more information about the Aberfoyle Farmers Market?
Absolutely. The website is afma.ca for the Aberfoyle Farmers Market.
And I've been talking with Peter McCluskey from the Aberfoyle Farmers Market. If you're interested in more information on what we've talked about today or previous shows or upcoming shows, please email me at waltergarrison@cfru.ca. All lowercase, all no spaces there. So waltergarrison@cfru.ca. This is Walter Garrison, the host of Locavore, heard on CFRU 93.3 FM, broadcast out of Guelph, Ontario.
Had a tough morning, slept in and you got a sore neck. Up all night drinking black coffee, smoking cigarettes. Car won't start, bus won't stop. Birds ain't singing and the sunlight's pouring the daylights out of you.
You're doomed with the blues, but you're not the only one. There's hope yet, son. The thrill is back. Every Monday from 2 to 3 p.m. with Andy and Andrew right here on CFRU.
You're listening to Groundwire, community news from coast to coast to coast.
We decided that we wanted to speak out for those families who are missing their loved ones, and there's not enough being done to catch the perpetrators that are killing off our women.
The community was totally shocked when the formal application was filed, because it is way bigger project than anybody had anticipated, including us.
We do need to talk about issues of violence against women. We need to talk about issues of violence against women across Canada, where it happens globally.
Work with international queer community members to transform other parts of the world.
Welcome to the July 17th edition of Groundwire, brought to you by the National Campus and Community Radio Association. Groundwire is grassroots news from people on the ground, coast to coast to coast. A different campus community station produces each episode of Groundwire. This time, it was CHRW in London, Ontario. All episodes of Groundwire are available for listening or podcasting at groundwire.ncra.ca. If you're interested in contributing as a journalist or producing an episode, get in touch with us by email at groundwire@ncra.ca. I'm Ed Von Attercass.
And I'm Nick Workman. Today on Groundwire, we have a report on challenge on the ban of medically assisted suicide in this country. We have a report on Toronto-based grassroots arts collective Buying for Young Women and Trans People Who Self-Identify as Muslims called Akazine. We have an interview with one of the organization for Walk for Justice, a walk to raise awareness and justice for Canada's murdered and missing women.
And we talk to David Heap of the Gaza Freedom Flotilla boat Tahrir. He gives us a first-hand account of the Tahrir's daring but ill-fated escape from Greece. All that's coming up, but first, headlines.
The Ministry of Children and Youth Services in Alberta came under fire in late June after it came to light that 6 children died in provincial care last year and 20 were hospitalized. These numbers are huge increases. The deaths doubling what they were the previous year and the injuries more than tripling. 5 of the 6 deceased children and 16 of 20 injured were Aboriginal. Alberta NDP MLA Rachel Notley has argued that in Alberta, deaths of children in care reported to be from natural causes are not counted. Critics say the system for reporting foster child deaths and injuries is too secretive, with a focus on covering up rather than advocating for and protecting at-risk children. The Ministry of Children and Youth Services, Yvonne Fritz, has said that the province may begin to conduct external reviews. Many think this isn't good enough and are calling for investigations to be completely independent from the government as done in other provinces like British Columbia.
On June 17th, Canada voted in favor of the United Nations Human Rights Commission resolution that recognizes sexual orientation and gender identity as essential human rights. Meanwhile, closer to home, David Pepper was on a cross-Canada tour with the North Star Triangle Project to raise awareness about LGBTQ refugees. He's promoting the Group of Five private sponsorship, which could mean for a refugee facing persecution, their life. A Group of Five pools $14,000 between themselves, along with a bunch of compassion and openness, in order to support a refugee during their first year in Canada.
If we can take all of the amazing things that we've accomplished here in Canada as queer people and bring other LGBT people from around the world to both enjoy the same rights and privileges we have, but in turn also work with the international queer community members to transform other parts of the world, to overcome the homophobia and the state-sanctioned murders that occur in parts of the world, and the overall intolerance that does exist for LGBT people. So engaging LGBT communities in international work and refugee sponsorship is I think good for everyone and enriches our community.
This all started last year when Pepper was agitated by a speech in which Jason Kenney, the immigration minister, challenged the LGBTQ community to do more for queer refugees. To make a long story short, he started a Group of Five last October. As he was reading up on refugee rights, he quickly discovered 5 major allies to LGBTQ refugees in Canada.
That's another example where I think Jason Kenney doesn't fully understand the dimensions of the LGBT community in Canada because he has this view that we're not doing enough, whereas in fact Rainbow Refugee, based in Vancouver, has been doing on-the-ground support for queer refugees for over 11 years.
Chrissy Gidiou, this is Melissa Albion.
A U.S.-based hedge fund has submitted a proposal for a mega-quarry in Melancton Township. Carl Kosak, a local rancher and vice chair of NDACT, the North Dufferin Agricultural Community Task Force, talks about how the quarry at the headwaters will affect the rest of southern Ontario and what's so unique about the farmland in this area.
It is home to a very unique feature, which is 15,000 acres worth of contiguous honeywood silt loam soil. Special because there isn't a stone to be found in it, and it grows almost any type of highland vegetable that you can think of. Canada only has about 3% of its land mass is agricultural land. Off that 3%, only 1% is this type of soil.
When the company originally bought the land from some local farming families, they posed as an industrial farming company and told the community that their intentions were to have a large potato-growing operation. By 2008, it became evident to the local community that their real intentions were to mine for the limestone.
The community was totally shocked when the formal application was filed because it is a way bigger project than anybody had anticipated, including us. And according to the application, they want to take this 30 feet of overburden off some 2,162 acres or something like that, which is about the size of 2,000 football fields. Like, we're talking just a huge area.
I'm Carly Forbes reporting for Groundwire.
And now it's time for the Community Radio Report. CFRC Kingston is launching a program to bring prisoners in the Kingston area penitentiaries messages from loved ones. The Prisoner Justice Day hotline is a phone line where loved ones and friends of prisoners incarcerated in Kingston can phone in and leave messages. These would be broadcast on CFRC on Prisoner Justice Day on August 10th. Vlada Bilyak is a programmer at CFRC.
Just because of this city has the largest concentration of correctional facilities in all of Canada. Mm-hmm. So there are currently 8 institutions. So we thought that with such a large concentration of correctional facilities in town, and so many of the inmates serving time here that were transferred here or are serving time here but are not from here, it would be a really great way to connect those prisoners with their loved ones. And just specifically talking about Kingston, there are a lot of families who move to town here to be closer to their loved ones that are imprisoned, but a lot of people also can't do that and don't really get a chance to see their family and friends behind bars very often. So it'd be a good way to connect and offer people an opportunity to send messages of love and support and comfort to those behind bars.
She says the hotline is operational 24/7 and toll-free. The number is 1-800-440-5219. The concept, says Bilyak, is taken from a phone line in Kentucky called Call From Home. While the messages will be aired on Prisoner Justice Day, Bilyak say they are looking into making this a permanent show on CFRC. And now for our features.
I'm Sam Kriviak, and this is an interview I did with Gladys Raddick, one of the organizers of the Walk for Justice, a walk to raise awareness and call for justice for Canada's missing and murdered women and their families.
My name is Gladys Raddick. I'm the co-founder of Walk for Justice, and what we are is a nonprofit organization, grassroots-based, and what we're doing is walking across Canada for the over 4,000 missing and murdered women across the nation.
So where did the march start, and where is it finishing up?
We started in Vancouver on June 21st, National Aboriginal Day, and we are going to be walking to Ottawa. We'll be arriving in Ottawa for September 17th, and we'll be holding a rally on Parliament Hill on September 19th, 2011. The rally is basically for the family members to voice their opinions on the inactions that are happening right across the nation in regards to protecting and helping the women in the country.
Actually, would you be able to speak a little bit more about the issue of missing and murdered women in Canada?
Yeah, well, this whole venture started with my niece who went missing from the Highway of Tears. Her name is Tamara Lynn Chipman. She disappeared from Prince Rupert, B.C. in September 2005. And when she went missing, I had the honor to meet another lady activist from Vancouver, and her mother and her two sisters were murdered in the downtown east side. And together we started compiling a database and realizing that there was far more to it than just our family members that were missing, and we decided that we wanted to speak out for those families who are missing their loved ones, and for many of them who have been served grave injustices in regards to how there's not enough being done to catch the perpetrators that are killing off our women.
So is this the first walk you've organized, or did this start a few years ago?
No, this is our fourth walk. We did walk in 2008. We walked from Vancouver to Ottawa. In 2009, we walked from Vancouver to Prince Rupert, B.C., to honor those from the Highway of Tears. And then also to complete the Highway of Tears, we walked the summer of 2010, we walked across from Kamloops to Winnipeg via Highway 16.
Okay, wow. So is there a website or anywhere online people can go for more information about the walk or to get involved?
Yes, we are on Facebook. You have to mark in walk, and then you have to use the number 4, Justice, Walk for Justice. On Facebook, and we also have a site at www.fnbc.ca and tag into Walk for Justice.
All right. Thank you so much for speaking with me. Is there anything else you would like to add before I close out?
Yes, I would. I would like to say that in every community, like since we've left, there's already been 5 women that have gone missing or been murdered since we left in June 21st. And when a woman goes missing and you hear about it, please reach out and help those families. Help them get through the troubles and the hardship that they're going through and help search for their loved ones and, you know, step up to the plate and honor the women. And I ask for the men to respect women as we are the life givers of society.
Excellent. Thank you so much. That was Gladys Raddick, one of the organizers of Walk for Justice. And I'm Sam Kriviak from CJSR in Edmonton, reporting for Groundwire.
And now, a feature from Contact, the interview program heard on VoicePrint, a service of Accessible Media Incorporated. I'm Jason Vermesh. The BC Civil Liberties Association recently announced their intention to challenge this country's laws banning medically assisted suicide. The association is joined in its lawsuit by Lee Carter, who accompanied her 89-year-old mother to Switzerland in 2010 to end her life. The elderly woman had a degenerative condition that left her in a wheelchair and experiencing chronic pain. It's been nearly 2 decades since the Supreme Court of Canada ruled against medically assisted suicide. This procedure, however, is permitted in Switzerland, Belgium, the Netherlands, and the state of Oregon. According to Grace Pasteen, litigation director for the BC Civil Liberties Association, the effort, if successful, will provide a constitutional and moral right to choose to die under certain circumstances.
Well, what we are seeking from the court is the constitutional right so that mentally competent adults who are suffering from serious and incurable illness will have the right to receive medical assistance to hasten death under certain specific safeguards. It is our belief, and we will argue this before the court, that every Canadian should have the choice to have what they consider to be a good death, and that includes the option of a medically assisted death. Inflicting unbearable suffering on dying patients who wish to end their lives with dignity is simply unjust, it's unacceptable, and it's unconstitutional. That does not mean that that is an option that every person who is seriously and incurably ill may want to take advantage of. In fact, if we look at other jurisdictions, it's a very small percentage of people who actually use medically assisted dying legislation.
Rhonda Weeb, co-chair of the Council of Canadians with Disabilities Ending of Life Ethics Committee, said there is potential for abuse with such a procedure.
There are many different abuses that can take place, and I think much of them stems from societal attitudes towards what it is to live with a disability. I am a person who lives with a life-threatening disability, and I have many things going on with me that incapacitate me in some way, and I need to find the supports to go on with my life and live fully and live well, and I'm sure that would echo what many Canadians with disabilities say, that the perception of the quality of their lives is lowballed by an ableist public.
Weeb said society's perception of people with disabilities and the quality of life is one of the many issues at the heart of the debate.
It's a good question, and it's a complex question. And one of the things that we are very concerned about is that if someone decides that they want to end their life and they go to their doctor and they say, you know, life for me just isn't worth living anymore, then all kinds of things get kicked into place and this person is seen as suffering from suicidal ideation and that they need counseling, that you know, there's a scrutiny of what's going on in their lives and what can be changed so that life does feel like it's worth living. As soon as that person has a disability and says, life isn't worth living, it seems like many Canadians are willing to go, yeah, I see what you mean, and not take any of those other steps. And the support should be in place so that you can live with that disability. Like many people, including myself, don't have fully functioning body parts. This isn't a reason to kill ourselves. It's a reason to make sure we have the supports we need to function independently. Function is really just a matter of perspective. I can't open doors or jars or thread a needle or stand on a slope or a million other things. So I have to find new ways to do it. So you need exposure to how other people with disabilities go on, kind of get over the adjustment they have to make. So why aren't we addressing this inclination to kill ourselves because we think it's better to be dead than disabled?
Grace Pastine expects this legal action to go all the way to the Supreme Court of Canada for a final decision. Both interviews can be heard in their entirety at AMI.ca. Look under the voice print page and search for the interview program Contact. For Accessible Media, I'm Jason Vermesh, reporting to Groundwire.
Axazine is a Toronto-based grassroots art collective by and for young women and trans people who self-identify as Muslim. They work from an anti-oppressive, pro-choice, queer-positive, and trans-positive framework. Ellie Gordon-Morshall from The F-Word on Vancouver Co-op Radio spoke with Axazine member Farah Khan. Here is a portion of that interview.
We started in 2007 when Axa Pervez was murdered. It was actually a day or two afterwards, a number of us came together and started just meeting and recognizing that there was very little space for us as young Muslim women to come together and grieve this murder of this young girl. She was a 16-year-old girl that was murdered by her father and her brother in 2007 in December. And so we recognized there was very few spaces outside of our mosque, outside of mainstream Canadian communities to really talk amongst ourselves. And we saw that there was such a power in us meeting and coming together. So we met randomly kind of for over a year. And then there was an article that came out by Toronto Life magazine in 2008 around the anniversary of Axel Revesz's murder. And it was an expose supposedly on, they called it Toronto's first honor killing, the immigrant issue. So you can imagine it caused a lot of great sadness, actually, amongst us. The cover had a very salacious picture of Axa Pervez on the cover, where she was airbrushed, where she looked naked. And it was really, I feel like it was a disrespectful kind of depiction of a young woman who was murdered. And I don't think that same depiction of a white woman would be happening in a major magazine. And they, you know, they argued back with us and said, you know, we need to talk about these issues. And definitely we do need to talk about issues of violence against women. We need to talk about issues of violence against women across Canada, where it happens globally. 1 in 3 girls before the age of 12 are sexually molested. 1 in 3 girls experience violence before the age of 18. We know on a spectrum this happens everywhere. But this magazine was so upsetting, and it was just like, that's it. This is the last straw. Like, we don't want anybody else speaking on our behalf as young Muslim women and trying to save us, right? From the war in Afghanistan to, you know, what's happening here in Canada, it seems that Muslim women's bodies become battlegrounds for people to, you know, use us to rationalize their war on terror, to rationalize the closing of immigration borders. So Axazine was started really to honor our voices and to create a space for us to speak for ourselves. There is a thing where we're kind of boxed in, not only from our communities in terms of media, but in our internal community. So we talk about dealing with structural violence, such as like Islamophobia, racism, xenophobia, like the hatred of immigrants, all those pieces, and also the stereotypes that come along with that. But also what happens inside our communities, right? So we were in Detroit just recently at the Allied Media Conference, and we had a caucus for Muslims. And we did a go-around. We said, what are the assumptions people have about you in the community and outside the community? And it was really interesting. Women who didn't wear hijab talked about people assuming that we're not religious. And the people that wore hijab, that they're super religious or that they're not born in Canada, right? So there's all these assumptions that come with it that we're trying to challenge, and everybody deals with, right? But it feels more in our microscope right now with all the war on terror and the obsession people have with us. Muslim women only account for 2% of the population in Canada, or Muslim people in general. but we have the corner on media. We're kind of running the show right now. Wow. Not running the show, but yeah. I wish we were running the show actually in some ways. But we're definitely like getting
attention.
We get a lot of attention, yeah.
Considering the attention around the niqab in Quebec, and it's, I don't know what the status on that, but about the women, the actual amount of women that wear it, what is it like?
It's a very small percentage, right? There's a very small percentage of women that wear niqab. Both of us have family members wearing niqab, and we actually, in Anoxazine, took on a campaign called the No Bill 94 campaign that now is morphed into the Right to Wear campaign, which looks at issues of women that wear the niqab and the hijab, and also women who don't wear them, and kind of how people are just so obsessed with our clothing, yet there's so few of us. You know, so it's again, like, what is this agenda about? It's not really about us. It's not about our liberation and our feminism, because that's what Sheree's government tried to say. It's about feminism. And it's really about actually telling women that they can't participate in society, that they don't allow to have rights.
Can one of you explain the significance of the hijab in soccer for what's been going on?
So FIFA has come up with saying that the Iranian team and the Jordanian team cannot play in the World Cup this year. So they were actually taken out of the World Cup soccer matches that were just happening right now. And they're saying that their hijab, for two reasons, that hijab can't be worn because nothing can be worn on the field for religious or political reasons. And another reason that they're saying is for safety reasons. Now, for the safety reason, we know that Muslim women in Ontario and Alberta are allowed to wear hijab in sports events, and they're okay. There's Muslim women that are weightlifters that wear hijab. There's Muslim women that wear hijab when they fence. There's Muslim women that wear hijab when they box. They are not getting harmed because of their hijab. And there's sport-like hijabs that are very close, forefitting to the head. So that's one piece, right? And then the other piece of what's really interesting is that in Quebec now, a young woman a couple years ago was kicked out of playing in her soccer league because she wore hijab. And now a young woman, 16-year-old woman, Sarah Bukrain, was kicked out of being a referee in a Quebec soccer match. So now we're really raising awareness around, why is FIFA doing this? And why are other places now taking on this law as well and saying that women can't play sports with hijab? And we know that sports are really important for young women, right? They build self-esteem, they build teamwork, and they're actually keeping us active. And this ban is not going to help women. This is actually going to deter women from playing soccer and playing sports.
That was Farah Khan of Anoxazine, which is spelled Anoxazine. Anoxazine was behind the mass solidarity soccer games that took place across Canada on July 7th in protest of niqab bans in the sport. The interview was provided by Ellie Gordon-Marshall of Vancouver Co-op Radio.
2 weeks ago, the Canadian Freedom Boat to Gaza made a break for freedom. Intending to sail to Gaza to break the Israel blockade, the Tahrir, along with the rest of the Freedom Flotilla to Gaza, found itself forbidden to leave the Greek port by the Greek government. But that wasn't the end of the story. On Monday, July 4th, the Canadian boat made a break for it, and was brought back to port 15 minutes later by the Greek Coast Guard. David Heap, a London professor and activist, was on the boat. We reached him in Greece. Here's an excerpt of that interview.
So take me through what happened.
Basically, we were being delayed after delay after delay after delay with paperwork from the Greek bureaucracy. It was clear that it wasn't just regular paperwork. It was politically motivated red tape. And then on top of that, last Friday, we got an order from the Minister of Civil Protection that no boats of this flag were to be allowed to leave Greek ports towards Gaza. So it was pretty clear by Monday that we weren't going to get our papers in order for a legal departure. So the Tahrir had at that point between 40 and 50 people, between delegates from Australia, Belgium, Canada, Denmark, and a few other places, and journalists from a number of places. So we took a vote of the delegates, and people were ready to leave without a legal crew. So with people, we had the great good fortune that among our varied crew, we had our volunteers. We had people from a maritime background who were competent navigators, even though they didn't have their papers with them. So we no longer had a Greek crew. We had released our Greek captain and crew because we couldn't ask them to defy Greek law because, you know, we put their livelihoods in danger. So we left, in defiance of the Greek government order and under volunteer crew, and we got about 8 nautical miles out of the port. We were able to do that because we left 2 volunteers behind in a little rented kayaks, and they got in the way of the Coast Guard boat. They bought time for us to get out of the port, and like I said, we made about 8 nautical miles in, I don't know, 15 minutes or 20 minutes or something like that, before we were boarded by armed commandos from the Greek Coast Guard Special Forces, who took control of the boat in the sea.
When they boarded your boat, did they treat you well? Were they violent?